Our comment today will be given by Stephen Rowe, who is Associate Professor of History at Chicago State University, where he is a member of what sounds like a very challenging department of Geography, Sociology, History, African American Studies, and Anthropology. We can only hope that it's a really congenial group. His scholarship has focused primarily on issues of education and labor in post-revolutionary France, with articles such as Writing Modern Selves, Literacy in the French Working Class in the Early 19th Century, published in the Journal of Social History in 2006, and The Politics of Literature and Literacy, Popular Songwriting and Proletarian Poetry in Post-Revolutionary France, published in Historical Studies and Education. He has a new project that is broader, rather intimidatingly so, a book manuscript called Working for War, Chinese, African, and Southeast Asian Laborers and the First World War in France.
Thank you very much for that introduction. And now that you all heard that, you're probably wondering, why is he up here speaking on the panel that focuses on the 17th century? And I would say, thanks to the panelists for inviting me, and one of the strengths I do see in this panel is that it is so tightly focused. The papers speak to each other in such interesting ways. And in particular, from a sort of outsider's perspective, by examining different forms in which France's relationships with the Ottoman Empire and Southeast Asia developed in the 17th century, these papers encourage us to consider the transnational history of early modern France in ways that reorient our focus from the West, in particular France's integration into the Atlantic world, to the East. But many of you can speak to that much more eloquently than I can, as I'm not an early modernist. And what I want to try and focus on briefly here, to allow time for other discussion, is just a few conceptual problems and things that might be worth thinking about. So the major problem I want to discuss is the concept of exchange, and what these papers suggest about how or even whether to consider the kinds of cultural relationships between France and the East in the 17th century through the concept of exchanges, which is in the title of the panel, after all. It is significant that we started off with Julia Gossard's paper, which takes this concept of exchange to its source in the activities of merchants as well as French state economic policy, and raises questions about the relationships between commodity exchange, language, and culture in the activities of the drogmans, or particularly the gens de langue, in the 1670s. While the Marseille merchants and the French state were clearly interested in the economic rewards that could be reaped through this expanding commodity exchange with the Ottoman Empire, Gossard turns our attention towards the dynamics of language and culture and her focus on the drogmans and the gens de langue. The question I have is, how should we consider the cultural activities and the emerging cultural hybridity of the gens de langue in light of their links to commodity exchange and mercantile activity? I raise this question in part because commodity exchange engaged in by the Marseille merchants, like commodity exchange conceived more broadly, implies a kind of reciprocity, a sort of exchange of goods for goods, in which, theoretically, both parties in the exchange see potential benefit. This notion of reciprocity and commodity exchange should make us wary, I think, of applying the concept of exchange to the realm of culture, for it has the possibility of making us overlook power relationships and their dynamics. Gossard seems to recognize the importance of power dynamics in the activities of the gens de langue by noting that the state employed the gens de langue as tools of colonization. But here the exact conception of this colonial project and its relationship to the activities of the gens de langue seems unclear. What sort of colonialism was this? And how were the politics of colonialism embedded in the activities of the gens de langue, the Marseille merchants, or even the French state and its orientation towards the Ottoman Empire at this time? This problem of the power dynamics in France's changing relationships with the East, whether conceived in terms of colonialism or otherwise, is also suggested by Ashley Brookbauer in her discussion of the diplomatic exchanges between King Narai of Siam and King Louis XIV of France in the 1680s. With, of course, her specific focus, as we just heard, on the material representations of the Siamese ambassador to in the 1686 Siamese embassy to Versailles. Brookbauer's reading of the visual material culture emphasizes that the supposed exchanges based around diplomacy, commerce, and religion were frequently represented in terms of French or Christian dominance or superiority over Siam or the greater Southeast Asian region. And here she might disagree with me given her closing comments about some of the ambiguity, and so I'm interested in hearing her address that as well as others. But in my mind, these representations of French dominance or superiority raise questions about the significance of seeing French-Siamese relations in the late 17th century in terms of an exchange, or if we should consider the asymmetrical representations as also tied to some form of colonialism. After all, Brookbauer points out potential links between images of French dominance with the significant military presence of the later French expedition to Siam, including plans to use force in Southeast Asia as needed. So here, Brookbauer seems to point our attention towards potential links between religious conversion and French military dominance, raising interesting questions about the politics of the exchanges she examines, and whether the concept of exchange is even appropriate to capture the meanings of the representations of changing cultural and political relationships between France and Siam in the late 17th century. If both Brookbauer's and Gossard's papers raise questions about the usefulness of seeing the relationships between France and the East in terms of exchanges due to specific power dynamics, Keith Luria's paper appears to suggest a series of cultural exchanges in the interactions between French Christian missionaries and local Vietnamese peoples in the 1660s to 1680s. In maintaining practices of polygyny and divorce in ways that sought to reconcile such practices with the Catholic sacrament of marriage and the church's marriage regulations, Luria argues that Vietnamese Christians adapted new religious ideas and practices to their own purposes. Was this, therefore, a kind of cultural exchange? That doesn't quite seem to be the case here either, despite the cultural hybridity that appears to have resulted among Vietnamese Christians. After all, Luria points out repeatedly that French Christian missionaries were frustrated by this emerging cultural hybridity, because it challenged their efforts to discipline the Vietnamese Christian community and to define clear boundaries between Vietnamese Christians and non-Christian Vietnamese communities. Thus, the cultural change here hardly appears to be one resulting from a reciprocal exchange, but one in which French or Christian cultural forms were interwoven with existing Vietnamese cultural forms by Vietnamese Christians, adopting and adapting Christian cultural traits and practices to their own local circumstances, despite the intentions and desires of the French missionaries. This kind of change seems to follow a diffusionist conception of culture and cultural change articulated in early American anthropology by Franz Boas, Ruth Benedict, and others. And here you'll forgive me for a brief minute. I taught briefly at the University of Chicago, since we're in Chicago, and this is what happens when you're at a place where we interact with scholars from many different fields. You start thinking of 100-year-old anthropologists when we read things like this. So Boas and Benedict emphasize that human cultures change over time due to the contact between different groups of peoples, leading to cultural traits and cultural forms being passed from one group to another, where the cultural forms or traits become integrated into, using Benedict's well-known book title, the group's pattern of culture. This resulting change cultural pattern is both more diverse and more complex than previously, and therefore cultural diffusion ultimately results in the increased diversity and complexity of all human cultures. This appears to be the sort of cultural change that Luria examines, at least when looked at from the perspective of the Vietnamese Christians. Furthermore, the cultural diffusion and resulting cultural hybridity analyzed by Luria in the case of Vietnamese Christians seems to parallel the kind of cultural hybridity that Gossard notes resulted among at least some of the Jeanne de Long in the Ottoman Empire. Their adoption of elements of Ottoman dress, for example, could be seen as following the kind of pattern of cultural diffusion that also appears to parallel Luria's examination of Vietnamese Christians and their marriage practices. However, since both of these cases of cultural diffusion appear to be unidirectional, one culture being adopted by the other and not that also cross-pollination happening, it seems difficult to reconcile the cultural changes examined by Luria and Gossard with the concept of exchange and its implied reciprocity. Thus, the commercial exchanges engaged by the Marseille merchants and the experiences of the Jeanne de Long in the Ottoman Empire, the diplomatic exchanges between France and Siam, and the activities of French Christian missionaries in Vietnam suggest that interactions between France and the East during the second half of the 17th century were ultimately based around asymmetrical relationships. This asymmetry suggests that we need to be attentive to the politics and power dynamics that operated in the cultural connections established between France and the East during this period. Why dwell on this? It's a long time to talk about the concept of exchange. I want to suggest that in doing transnational history, and especially transnational history with a focus on culture and cultural change, we must not divorce ourselves from politics or the political dimensions of that transnational history. After all, the mere act of doing transnational history in the contemporary world is itself a political act. Whether we consider the current politics of immigration and race in the US or France, or the response of European states and peoples to the migration of peoples from Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean. And so here, not to throw too many things out there, but here I'm really thinking about Bill Sewell's discussion of the political unconscious of social and cultural history in a really brilliant essay he wrote about 10 years ago. So here, the three excellent papers in this panel demonstrate that examining the relationship between France and the East in the 17th century, we should consider those relationships in the realms of culture, economics, and politics by situating the interactions between merchants, translators, diplomats, and religious figures within an understanding of the politics at work in those interactions, moving beyond the concept of exchange. Thank you.
Wonderful papers. And I just had a question for Julia Gassa. I was wondering if the fluid clothing options of the Jeanne d'Along, was that more in the early 18th century that was happening?
Yeah, well, they start doing it in the 1680s, but by 1732 it actually looks like it had become standard practice.
Right, so that's what I was wondering about, the sort of the tulip era and the reign of Ahmed III. Mm-hmm. And I have a memory from something I read a long time ago that there was a loosening of strictures for Ottoman clothing in that period. And I was wondering if maybe one was influencing the other.
I actually don't know, but now you've led me in a new direction to actually investigate that, so thank you.
Hi, I have a question actually also about clothing. But it's actually more to Ashley Grubacher, which is about the pointy hats that the Siamese are wearing, because I know that different ethnic groups, as depicted in French art, can get marked with particular headgear in particular. But I work on the Ottomans in France, and therefore, you know, I think about trying to spot turbans. Yeah. The one thing that occurred to me when I was looking at those Almanac pictures is that they actually really resemble, I don't know if you've ever seen the engraving from the Bourgeois Gentilhomme from the scene. They're all wearing pointy hats also. They're not wearing turbans. So there's this interesting elision that mm-hmm. seems to be going on visually between the Siamese and the Turks that I hadn't actually thought about it until just now,
yes.
But I don't know who made that engraving in the Bourgeois Gentilhomme, but they're wearing pointy hats, not turbans.
that's a really interesting point, and I have seen that print, but I hadn't thought about that connection. One thing that I didn't note in the paper, but that's really interesting, is that the Siamese dress you see represented in the images I showed is not traditional Siamese dress. Which was Mandarin dress. So what had happened is earlier, the decade previous, Persian culture became huge at the Siamese court with diplomatic exchange, and so the Siamese started adopting Persian robes, and so they're actually being shown in that dress.
So the Persians wore the
pointy hat? No, the hat is something totally separate, but the funny thing is you also see French ambassadors in Siam wearing the pointy hat, which makes me question. At first I thought it was totally fantastic, but then that makes me question, maybe it wasn't totally fantastic if you also see these French diplomats wearing this hat as well, which seems to be, you know, unrelated to either Persian or Ottoman dress. Yeah, so it's curious, but if anyone has any ideas, I'd love to know the origin of the pointy hat besides birthdays and whatnot. And it does have a little strand too, and they describe it in detail in the text that is the conical hat. So, I mean, they seem very particular that they're not making it up.
Right, but it also seems to resemble, I don't know what the origin is of the dunce's hat is, because, I mean, I think, isn't that also, when you think about images of
Atenaeus,
that's what they're wearing there?
Yeah.
So I think maybe it's some weird inversion of, you know, they're converting infidels by making them wear the uniform of bad Christians.
Well, interesting.
I'd have to just research it more, but I think that's really
I have a question for Keith. In early modern Europe, there's such a wide disparity of definitions of what conversion means. Mm. And for example, in Spain, you could be a devout Christian for four generations if you were Morisco Morano, and that still wasn't good enough. And in the French Wars of Religion, Huguenots who were abjuring had to live Catholicly, which meant go to confession, go to mass, practice the sacraments. Was there any written or perceived definition of what a real conversion meant in Vietnam? Was it more than just you only had one wife?
Yeah, I think it was more than that. Although I don't think this rule is consistently applied, both in the Jesuit accounts, which come from the first half of the century, and then the Meta accounts, which come later, they talk about a certain basic sort of minimum of belief and a minimum of instruction that's required. And I'm afraid at the moment I can't give you the entire list, but there's a certain sets of things that each convert should be able to know and to be and stuff. I mean, whether or not those standards are applied consistently in all circumstances, I mean, clearly they're not. Not when they're baptizing 47 people at once. But certainly there are frequently, the accounts of the conversions, and here I'm going back to the Jesuit books as well, kind of exist in the accounts on two different levels. When it's a question of the conversion of a member of the Mandarin or the royal elite, or of the Buddhist clergy, then there's a certain, greater amount of detail that's given, and hence the question of more instruction and so forth. When it's the conversion of people such as, in the fishing villages in Nam Province and Southern Tonkin, then there's really no differentiation made whatsoever, and that's apparently where the Jesuits and them were making large numbers of conversions. So much of what you see in terms of a somewhat more exacting expectation of conversion really really depends on the sort of social background baptized. Once they're baptized, then again there's a great disparity. Some, in certain places, if we believe the accounts, they live essentially in Christian communities with the majority or in some cases everyone is. And there you probably can expect, it seems to me, although there's not a great deal of description of it, a more recognizably Catholic existence. In communities which are more mixed, then it's really much harder to say. But again, when they dwell on individuals, which tend to be more elite converts, there is great attention to their fervor, to their religious practice, and then the particularly important group of martyrs. And there are large numbers of them across the 17th century, which bespeaks a certain level of fervor.
I had a quick question for Ashley. So looking at the engravings of the Siamese ambassadors coming to Versailles, in one of them, which you pointed out, there's a small inset of French ambassadors going to Siam. I've seen larger versions of that before where the French ambassador is handing up like a platter with the letter from Louis XIV up to Narai, who's up in his high window. So I wanted to ask about what the representation, I guess, of the obverse says to a story that you get close of the other one. The other thing I wanted to suggest about this discussion of the hat is immediately, I mean, I'm very much a newcomer to the French and Southeast Asia, but the hats immediately recall to me the temples that you see in Ayutthaya. They look a lot.
Oh, you're right. Like, yes.
The temples.
Like a stupa.
Yeah,
too.
Exactly,
yeah.
Like a stupa. So, anyway. A suggestion from a pure newcomer.
Hat mystery. Yeah, so what's interesting, and that I didn't have time to go into in the one print, is that little cameo that shows the French in Siam during the 1685 embassy is actually positioned as a diplomatic triumph on behalf of the French and Louis XIV. So what has happened there is the French ambassadors have come in and they're offering this letter to Narai. Well, in French diplomatic custom, the letter always had to be presented directly to the hand of the king, which was not the custom in Southeast Asia when you would actually have it kind of elevated up. So what happens is a sort of mishmash of cultures where you have them sort of putting it up, but then making Narai bend down. So he's not actually taking it from the hand of the ambassador, but is having to bend down. And so then the French say, oh, well, look at us. We talked them. We got Narai to bend down to greet us. And then you'll also notice that none of the French ambassadors are bowing to the Siamese ambassador, because it's not their custom. But you'll always see the Siamese bowing. And so you see there's actually a really interesting figure. Narai's main minister was Greek. Was a great gentleman, and he is kind of pleading with them, like, oh, please try to bow, because you're being really disrespectful right now. But then Louis says, this is a diplomatic triumph for us, because we got what we wanted, and we were really culturally insensitive, and he's saying that as a positive at this point.
That's interesting, because it's like, how much do you read it? If it's a compromise, who ends up on top in the compromise? Like,
yeah, and he's definitely trying to position himself on top as much as possible.
Okay. One more question? No more questions. Oh.